Sourcing Matters Podcast. This is your host, Aaron Niederhelman, sharing stories of our food.
Okay, welcome back to Sourcing Matters. And today, Mr. Nathan Roman is joining me as my co-host. Hey, Nathan, how you doing?
Doing great, Aaron. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. So this is kind of same old gig, different locations.
Yeah,
huh?
It's been a little while.
It has been a little while between our last shows, maybe a couple years now.
A few, yeah.
But, hey, Nathan, we are welcomed today by a wonderful guest, Lisa Sebesta, who is the managing partner and co-founder of Fresh Source Capital. Hey, Lisa.
Hey, Aaron. Hey, Nathan.
Hey, Lisa.
So, Lisa, we've obviously known each other for quite a while here, and I have a good feel for what you're up to, and we've been on a few panels, a few discussions. And I just want to say a couple things that I've been so impressed by what you guys have accomplished with Fresh Source Capital, coming early to market, looking at your mid-market investments, and then really scaling it out and creating leadership throughout the middle market infrastructure and looking at new ways of bringing in different capital. So you should be commended. You and Dan Pullman should be commended for your actions. And I just want to throw that out there and make you feel happy and put a smile on your face so we have a good interview.
Well, thank you, Aaron. I appreciate that. We feel like there's still a lot of work that to be done and that could be done. And we're excited to, you know, continue in this work. But I think, as you said, I think it is early in this process.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about your background, because obviously it's very apropos for what we're talking about of regional and local food systems, looking at new investment vehicles. So you were in a leadership position currently within Slow Money Boston. You had some past work where you were a senior investor for the Fair Food Fund. And then obviously 5 years ago, 4 years ago, you started the...
4 years.
4 years ago, you started Fresh Source Capital, a bit of an idea and scoped out the due diligence. But you raised a first fund, and now you're in the process of raising a second fund. Could you tell us a little more about where you're at and what your objectives are?
Sure. So my background is actually in finance, in public equity financing. I was a portfolio manager for a number of years. But most of my work in those years, during those years, was focused on sustainable investing and socially responsible investing. And so in my move towards private markets, first of all, I wanted to have more of an impact with the investments I was making, both personally and professionally. And regional food systems was just such a great opportunity that we saw. And as I met Dan in that journey, and we both shared that vision of really mobilizing more institutional capital into the space. We see it very much as consumer demand driven. Consumers these days are so much more focused on what they're eating, on making healthy food decisions, both in the home, in the grocery store, as well as in restaurants. And that's really permeated the whole food supply chain. And it's really been small, nimble entrepreneurs that have been able to come in and fill the space. It's really the innovation these days is not coming, as we're seeing it, not coming from big food. So that was really what prompted us to start Fresh Source Capital 4 years ago. And as you said, we raised our first fund that was relatively small in 2015. We've now made 12 portfolio investments out of that fund. And we feel that fund is now fully committed to those 12 companies. And we want to continue this work. We feel like there's a lot of still great opportunities in the space. And that's what's leading us to launch a second fund or to fundraise for it.
Hmm.
As somebody who's kind of new to this industry, systems and such, can you go a little bit more, go deeper in terms of how this is beneficial for somebody like myself who is not as in deep, but, you know, concerned about what I eat? Aaron and I were talking about this earlier in terms of the reason why we want to have these environments for these animals is because it actually benefits us as humans biologically. It's not just we want to, you know, have happy cows or happy chickens, but there's an actual biological and physiological benefit for that. For somebody like myself, would you mind like going a little bit deeper on why what you do is important?
Sure. So, you know, we finance the businesses that are rebuilding regional food systems. And we see sort of our overarching theory is that food systems are decentralizing, that all the, you know, starting around World War II, there was a great effort towards centralizing and industrializing the food system in the name of efficiency. But in that drive towards efficiency, we lost a lot of benefits along the way. And I think now we are seeing the negative externalities from all that centralization, coming from depletion of the soil to, depletion of the nutritional value of a lot of processed foods. And so it's really been, I think, the last 10 or so years where we've seen a shift. I mean, I think there's always been interest in organic and local foods at some level, certainly as long as I can remember. But I think this really marked shift has come in the last 10 years where consumers are saying, hey, I'm really focused on healthier products. And that has actually led towards consumers asking more questions, about, where is this food coming from? Who grew it? Can I trust this source? How far removed am I from this supply chain? Is it coming from around the corner, or is it coming from another part of the world? Hmm. So basically, I mean, I guess to answer your question, the work that we're doing is really trying to support these entrepreneurs that are coming in to fill that demand gap, or that demand that's there, and the supply gap that existed.
Ooh, externalities and true cost accounting. Now you're talking my language. I love it. So this is good stuff. Some of the portfolio companies that you guys have put together, Imperfect Produce, Ocean Approved, Bento Box, Farmers to You, Hudson Valley Harvest, Little Leaf Farm, spoiler alert, just had Cooking and Red's Best, all I think have developed into household names if you're into our local or regional food movement. So the question again, and this is my last softball question, Lisa, is, wow, if we didn't have fresh source capital, would we have a local food movement at all or a regional food movement? That's rhetorical, I know. But yeah. Let's actually go a little deeper into this, because so I'm driving in and I'm listening to the radio and they're talking about how more consumers for their Thanksgiving dinner are really looking for fresh. They're looking for food of elevated standards and they're looking for local. But then I just saw another article that's saying we're spending less on this year's Thanksgiving than we have in 5 years. So what gives, and how can we have both cheap food and cheap food?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's really the big conundrum. I think traditionally that the bad rap for local food is that it's more expensive. In some cases, that's absolutely the case. A lot of it is very seasonal. It's very easy to get inexpensive apples and pears and peaches here in the fall. But if you're trying to get local in the spring for those goods, obviously that's going to be more expensive because they had to be stored somewhere and there's extra costs associated with that. I think that it's difficult for us to sometimes reconcile the local with the cheap. And again, the whole drive towards centralization was really around efficiency and making things cheap. But if we're really focused on foods that are better for us and better for the planet, again, those externalities come into play. And somewhere along the line, those have to be accounted for. Let's take turkey for an example. I think there's plenty of opportunities to get very inexpensive turkey in any local supermarket.
I see them walk around Harvard Square.
Yeah, the wild ones. I don't know how you're going to catch those and prepare it for dinner, but I'm sure maybe some people are up for that.
Maybe with the Volkswagen.
Exactly.
But you compare that to I'm actually getting my Thanksgiving turkey from Farmers to You, and they source all of their poultry from Misty Knoll Farms, which is based in Middlebury, Vermont. And is it more expensive than the turkeys at Market Basket? Absolutely. It's probably comparable, or maybe it's probably on par with what you might find at a Whole Foods. I'm buying it because of really two reasons. First of all, I think Farmers to You is a great company. It's where I get most of my groceries now because it's very convenient. They deliver it to my house. But more importantly, I think for this discussion is that the company has really vetted all of its suppliers and really has a good handle on You know, who is it who's growing this food? How is it being produced? Is it being produced in a way that's consistent with my values as a farmer to you, customer? And so that's why I'm buying it from them. And yes, I am willing to pay a little bit more for that. So I guess I'm not in that that average category of probably spending the same amount of money as I did last year.
Well, that's, I mean, look, that's great. And I was actually going to ask how you source your Thanksgiving table. So perfect. And I know you work with Farmers to You.
Yeah.
But I also think what I find intriguing in your portfolio companies is you guys think a little bit outside the box as well. You look at efficiencies and inefficiencies, how to solve the inefficiencies, mm-hmm. and where to intertwine better efficiencies. And whether that's Little Leaf and looking at local hydroponics at scale, using yep. some of the best world-class models for doing so, or looking imperfect produce, which looks at ugly fruit that never makes it to the mainstay of the shelves that we look and see this incredible bounty when you walk into Whole Foods and see those right. apples. And I become so picky because one has a little brown spot on. Isn't it amazing how it's all relative to what we see in front of us?
Right.
Or even Ocean Approved, who's changing the way that we look at using sea greens coming out of our oceans from mm-hmm. this clean, cold water. So it seems what you guys do very well is figuring out where we can walk before run, or maybe even crawl before walking, and figuring out where efficiencies can happen before revolutionizing new systems. Because when we start getting into what the capital costs are for real assets, for infrastructure, for doing mainstay and large scale agricultural restructuring, that may be a bit of a challenge, and we're going to need examples like you have created to show that there's some economic stimulus, there's some capacity for growth in moving in that direction. So that's a long way of leading up to a question,
okay.
and I know, but I had to, so I told Nathan I was going to stop spouting out and like grandstanding ideas, but I can't help myself, I guess. So really looking at if we do, so we in the Northeast source less than 10% of our own food.
Yeah.
And I think I'm being generous by saying 10%. So looking at it from a capital side, looking at it from both an institutional side and then the interest of family offices or private equity or even high net worth philanthropic donors, where do we start getting to a point in our region and in others that don't have the same capacity, whether they're food deserts because they only do one crop, or there's really one state in this country that does multi-dimensional things, that's California.
Mm-hmm.
But aside from California, how do we get to a point where we can get 20, 30, 40, 50% food independent for our supply chain? Because when you start looking at the overall impact, it is externalities cost on environment for these shortcuts and large-scale production models. There is the local dollar spent capacity of getting more interest, of getting your farmers some more money and more value. But What greases the skids? What
yeah.
gets it going? How do we begin this to actually start to develop some scale to solve this problem?
Well, I absolutely think that the work we're doing, you know, I don't want to give ourselves too much credit because we're really, you know, responding to consumer demand, both in terms of what we're seeing in the food world, you know, people wanting better for you food, more traceability, more sustainability. So we're supporting the entrepreneurs that have proven that they are addressing that need. And also on the investment side, I think people want to know more, or be kind of more clued in as to what their investments are doing and what impact those investments are having, you know, on the world, on the environment. There's a great study done by Food Solutions New England. You can Google it. It's called Food Vision New England. I think it's called Food Vision 2060.
Mm-hmm.
So they did a really comprehensive study on what it would take to, you know, as you're saying, boost that percentage of food that New Englanders buy from within our six states. The vision, the goal is really to get to 50% food security by 2060. That actually requires a lot of work. report really focused on is two things. One is land access. So right now it's about 3 million acres in New England is focused on food production. To get to a point where we're at 50% food security, it's going to have to triple from here. So we're going to have mm-hmm. to get to 9 million.
Mm-hmm.
The authors of this study recommend that a lot of that, most of that land come from what's actually currently conserved as forest.
Mm-hmm.
with the idea if that is used, if it's farmland but farmed in a responsible and sustainable way, that we're not going to, that we're still going to be, you know, maintain, you know, good air quality, preserve land, preserve soil, and not deplete the soil. Some of that land can also come from urban sources, from rooftops, from containers, from other innovative sources, not just conventional farmland. So I think that paper actually, that report really lays out a vision for how we get there on the land access side. To get to that 50%, there probably will be some changes in diet too. Mm-hmm. You know, I think one of the biggest recommendations is eating less meat, particularly less beef, but sourcing almost all of that beef locally and from sustainable sources. Eating a lot more vegetables. Actually, we have great capacity to grow almost all vegetables that you would eat in New England. Again, we have the seasonality issue, but if we can build on infrastructure to better process, freeze, store, do other, make them shelf stable or frozen, there are ways that we can you know, have access year round to local produce that we don't really focus on right now. So I think basically it's kind of, first and foremost, I think it really has to come from consumer demand. Are consumers, are they going to ask for this, or is it going to be kind of at the you know, sort of the back burner? Right. But to the extent that consumers are looking for more locals, you know, I think one of the biggest drivers of local food right now are institutions.
Yeah.
Certainly colleges, driven by the Real Food Challenge, are looking to source more locally. A lot of local colleges have signed on to the idea of sourcing at least 20% by 2020. I mean, that's a pretty aggressive goal for right now if we're only at 10. UMass Amherst, which is, first of all, it's a large university. It sources a great deal locally already, but they're committed to the full 50% by 2060. Mm. So that's a pretty, again, that's a pretty aggressive goal. There needs to be a lot of changes in our food system if we're going to get there. So I think it starts with land access and consumer demand and profile. But then there are also a lot of capital investments that have to happen beyond the farm. So in terms of food processing, in distribution networks, transportation, storage, those are a lot of capital investments that, you know, we haven't put a number on that yet, if that's your next question. but yes, there's a fair amount of real capital investment that has to happen.
That can be my next question.
Okay.
I'll set you up again. I do want to continue on this theme of looking at the capital requirements because, yeah, I mean, how do you deal with scale? How do you deal with, I mean, really what we're talking about is transitioning the enthusiasm and excitement of the consumer that's in the local food movement and make it something that's economically feasible, like a regional food movement. Mm-hmm. And whether it induces scale or division of labor, lack of operational capital or real asset investments or infrastructure, or just the infighting amongst different groups that are trying to fight over hyper local and not working together, those have all been limiting factors of actually getting us into a regional environment. And why I'm excited for what you guys are doing, you're a bit rogue. You are one of the, Fresh Source is one of the only few that are investing in this type of programs and are coaxing along a larger scale investor into this. So if that's the, we need orders of magnitude higher amounts of capital, we have to start to engage those customers deeper. Can we wait till generation next so that we get to that point where consumers are really driving this? Or are there ways that we can infuse the market in a more pragmatic approach and engage the larger buyers to see these as pragmatic investments or investments of the future, or starting to add those real cost-based accounting to the way that food really costs?
Right.
And that's a, I know, a much broader conversation, but from the financier side, have you looked at that? Have you looked at adding that framework and developing so people can think differently on an economic side that, you know, this makes sense. We should be really evaluating, not within our long horizon, but within a maturity of an average private equity fund within a decade. You should be looking at these differences.
Yeah. You know, I was just last week at a meeting at the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston. They had recently...
Which you spoke at, in fact.
Yes, I was on a panel was put together by our friend Gray Harris, who I think you know from CEI. Sure. And Gray had worked with a fellow at the Federal Reserve Board in conjunction with a book that they had just published about regional food systems and the opportunity for essentially for economic development by investing in regional food systems. Mm-hmm. So the focus of that meeting was really how do we encourage more investment into the sector to build it out, and how do we leverage different types of capital? So, you know, to your question about venture capital, we're focused on very specific types of businesses. It has to be a growth business. Mm-hmm. We do both debt and equity investments, but, you know, by the nature of our fund and its structure, we need to see a return within, you know, the life of our fund. And our first fund is 8 years. Our second fund will probably be 10. Mm-hmm. But so to the extent that there are investments needed that are longer term than that, that's just not something that Fresh Source is going to be able to do. Mm-hmm. So I think if we engage different types of investors who do have that ability, foundations certainly do, private family offices have that, we can really leverage more capital like ours to come into the space if they're there as that kind of patient long-term capital. And that was kind of the gist of that meeting. Because I think what's important for us to understand is that every investor in the space has their own constraints and their risk profile and kind of their own objectives. One of the things that we want to do, and I think Fresh Source is trying to do this, is really identify who these investors are and then bring them together. And hopefully together we can figure out ways to make the system work and make sure that the businesses that need investment and that are worthy of investment get the right type of capital.
Hmm. Have you had any of those larger LPs or foundations asked to share due diligence or to co-invest in any of the companies that you're looking at? Or have you been able to keep those relationships aside and just funnel them through the traditional Fresh Source approach?
So in almost every single one of our investments, we co-invest.
Okay.
In some cases, they're institutional investors or other funds. Some cases, they're family offices. In a few cases, they're individuals. It really varies a lot, but we absolutely like to share due diligence and are very happy to co-invest.
So let's quickly return back to your Thanksgiving table.
Sure.
Or mine or Nathan's.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter. I just want to mention, so, you know, we try to source similar to you. We focus on, to us, you know, the silver bullet of changing food is sourcing, right? That's the whole approach. If we actually look at the models used for raising animals or agriculture, reducing persistent pesticides, being aware of what's happening in food systems, that's really how we change food. So we do focus on that, but I'm setting that up to say I still love that damn gelled cranberry sauce. I like, we still get the can of it. My wife like scoffs me off with this and like, oh geez, you know, like you open up the BPA can, this gelatinous mess pops out, but man, that stuff is just, it brings back these flavor profiles that probably are not good, but I just love it. I look
beets
forward to my
too,
winter.
Yeah. The purple beets.
The purple beets.
Purple beets.
That's right. So I think what I'm saying is that, right, if we stay 80% core to eating good food, and sometimes when you get stuck eating White Castle or you get stuck eating gelatinous cranberry sauce, it's okay, right? I'm almost trying to be absolved of my past eating sins too, right? Lisa, tell me,
sure.
Tell me that it's okay.
It's all okay.
Okay, good, yeah. Good. All right.
So, but food is such an emotional thing.
I mean, really
I think that's it's such a part of the equation, and that's why so many people, I think, care so much about the food that they're eating and what they're feeding their families.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's such an underlevered way of telling that story, right? I mean, cultural, or your family, your grandmother, all these things, and there's nothing like the olfactory senses that trigger memories.
Absolutely.
And, you know, no matter how complex we get with faking food or looking at different alternatives to food, when you get a really high quality piece of meat or you get excellent food, you taste the difference. We have such complex olfactory symptoms that it's amazing when you get that robust flavor of things. You know, you can't replicate it. So, but I just want to return to the and talk about with Thanksgiving and many of the holidays, and really as a collective, food waste becomes a major issue, right?
Yeah.
And what I wanted to talk to you about, two things there. Obviously, I'd love to talk about spoiler alert and see what they're doing, because it's a very creative approach to this. But how can we look differently at this? I mean, there are a couple aspects of this, right? So of course there's going to be food waste. So let's compost the stuff that's really going to be used. And everyone can do this composting at home. It's not a big deal. There's even services that come pick this stuff up. That is energy lost if we don't do that. If it's going to a landfill, that can be returned back to a compost or the next iteration. That's really an opportunity to make food cheaper, especially with this regenerative approach, right? Mm-hmm. The second is so much of food waste, we talk about upwards of 40%, depending on food categories, is just because it's ugly, because it doesn't meet the standards, because it doesn't follow into the cold chain in the right way. Mm-hmm. So obviously that's maybe where spoiler alert comes in, is finding optimum ways to get those larger players in the supply chain to be engaged, to find out new ways of reaping benefit for addressing food waste. Mm-hmm. But also in looking at it from the production side, which we care about greatly, is there's a great deal that's lost on the farm, or really in fisheries specifically,
right,
with bycatch and things that just the market's not there. So you catch this animal, it gets dragged for 4 hours, you pull it on deck, and oh, we're not looking for that one.
Right.
Flop it over the river, which an estimated 63 billion pounds of dead loss every year because of bycatch. That's a significant amount, with 3 billion people around the world relying on sea protein as their major caloric intake. So I just gave you a ton of information.
Yes.
There. I know. But answer to me, if you would, looking at your dining room table, what can people do? You know, it's spoiler, it's an interesting approach, but what can people look differently about reducing that sheer volume of waste that gets put in the trash?
Yeah.
Real quick, what is spoiler alert?
Well, there you go. Good setup. Okay.
So they're a technology company. They're based in Boston, founded by two MIT Sloan Business School alums. They have built a software platform that helps match food donors, so institutions, retailers, grocers, distributors, to food banks and other food rescue operations. So they've kind of built a marketplace that does that matching, which to create an efficiency, which where previously had been very inefficient. Mm. They rely on, for revenue, they rely on the for-profit donor. There's actually a tax law that was passed in 2015 that allows an enhanced deduction for donated food. And that's really kind of the driver of the revenue model of Spoiler Alert. So they work with a major food distributor. That's kind of their main first client here in Boston, to essentially help that distributor at the end of every day or at every week figure out how they can distribute what otherwise they would have to either throw away or would be very highly inefficient for them to try to figure out what to do with. So back to your question, Aaron, about food waste at the table.
Awareness of it, yeah.
Awareness of it. Well, absolutely. I think awareness is absolutely the first step. I think also, looking for buying from farmers markets, being open to, you mentioned imperfect produce earlier, but being open to, food that doesn't necessarily look perfect, but it's perfectly nutritious. Mm-hmm. You know, carrots that have, two legs, or, a heart-shaped potato.
Yeah. And I love the photo shoots.
Yeah,
of those,
Imperfect's done an absolutely amazing job of really showcasing that and embracing it, which is great. I think Thanksgiving is also really a time of abundance. So, there's a natural tendency to cook a lot of food. And I think just thinking creatively about what to do with leftovers, not necessarily throwing it all in the trash or even composting it all, but even thinking through, can we make soup out of this? Can we do other things? I think at the retail level, I think what the food waste that you're really trying to address is that a higher level. Yeah. I mean, I think there's certainly things that any household can do to help reduce waste. So much of it happens before it ever gets into a household.
Or the supply chain.
Into the supply chain. And I think that's what companies like Spoiler Alert and Imperfect are really trying to address. I think there are also a lot of, getting to your question about bycatch, I think there are a lot of innovative chefs who are taking this issue on. Trying to do, make really interesting and delicious recipes out of underloved or underutilized species or parts of the animal that otherwise would normally wouldn't be used.
Right. And that's effectively because we're in a situation where, and we should explain that bycatch is, again, when you go out fishing as fishermen, you have a certain level of quota for a specific species. And if you catch something else that is an underutilized species, often it's not worth pulling it in because it just takes up room and you're not going to get a market to sell it to. So by working with chefs or other folks that are engaging consumers in this, they're creating a market for that. And maybe it covers fuel cost for the day, but there is some value to that. And we're not dumping it over the side of the gunwale, making values from that, right?
Yeah.
So Lisa, where can people learn more about Fresh Source Capital? And do you have any other speaking engagements coming up where they can meet you in person?
We'll certainly go to our website, freshsourcecapital.com. There's a little bit about myself and Dan Pullman, my business partner, on there. You'll see our portfolio companies and links to their website. So please take a look there. And, you know, actually, we're going to be putting together, and maybe I'll eventually post it on our website, but initially for our investors, kind of a little Christmas list or holiday list of things that you know, maybe they can shop for you through our portfolio companies or give as gifts, or just innovative ways of thinking about how to tie food back into the holiday season and giving season.
I love it. It's like the Sears wish book for local food.
Yeah,
food.
Right.
Yes.
But I think it all really starts with asking questions and being an informed consumer. And I think that's really the heart of this whole movement is consumers just really caring about where their food is coming from and wanting to know more about it. And that just is what leads to this great entrepreneurship and innovation that we've seen in the space.
I do have a question, like somebody who is not in the industry at all, other than wanting me to eat better, what would be either of you an action plan, call to action, whatever you want to call it, that you would say to a whole bunch of me? I live in the neighborhood across the street. We've got all my neighbors. What would you all want us to know and do, ideally?
I think, again, it's that awareness. Mm-hmm. So whether if you cook a lot on your own, so if you go to a grocery store, I would just kind of think about, you know, where you get your food from. So if you're shopping through a grocery store, you know, looking at labels, a lot of grocers now, I mean, Whole Foods kind of started this trend, but many of them do that now, highlighting what's local. And you certainly do that. You could look at online alternatives for getting groceries delivered. Farmers to You is an online grocer. Just Add Cooking is a meal kit company. Mm-hmm. So if you're looking to get, you know, sort of all the ingredients to prepare certain meals ahead of time, you can use them for that. But we recognize too that so many people spend a lot of money at restaurants. I think 2016 was the first year that money spent in restaurants was actually exceeded money spent on groceries. Mm. And asking, you know, your restaurateur or where is the food coming from, or just making that aware, or even if it's, I know Aaron's very familiar with a lot of the quick service chains now that are really focused on sourcing, and again, it's very much driven by consumer demand. And also, I think corporations feeling that they want to be more responsible in terms of not just what they're feeding their constituents, but how they're treating the planet and the animals that they end up using.
I couldn't agree more, Lisa. I mean, I think, Nathan, in looking at this, we have to come to a realization that we're often, as consumers, already doing this in coffee, in beer, in sweets, savories, wine. There are all of these things that we have these differentiation of expectations that we're looking for, everything from terroir to roasting practice to fair trade for actually raising out certain food stuff. And then others were completely unaware of what's going on. And often with some of the major things like the salad plate and the center of the plate, the meat, which makes collectively up about 70% of what goes through wholesale, we've turned a blind eye. And it really is a false economy when you start to break it down of what the effects are on the environment, on our own health, mm-hmm. and that these are sentient animals in some cases, especially with food animal production, which mm-hmm. is a significant portion of that. So, I think it's an awareness, and I think it's an incubation. I think it's a process that we'll get there, and it is a systems mm-hmm. thinking approach. which people seem to be more engaged with maybe in your generation than ours. For Lisa and I, it's maybe a bit of a constant battle. The other question I was going to ask you is, don't you sit there when you're feeding the folks that in your family that don't care about this, but you're feeding them all this elevated standard food? You're like, what am I just wasting this food on them for? They don't even think twice
about
it.
Sometimes we joke around, like, you know, if we get, you know, some, like a really nice piece of meat or something, we'll say, all right, this is too good for the kids. Yeah, right. But I also want to, you know, I don't want to come across as, you know, that all local food is elite or elitist and expensive.
Right.
And because I that's not true.
Yeah.
There's certainly, as I said, there's a lot of seasonality in New England, and but you can certainly access a lot of really great local food during the right time of year.
Yeah.
I mean, we just went through a fantastic harvest season.
That's right.
But even, you know, Aaron, you mentioned earlier Little Leaf Farms.
Yep.
Out in Devens, Mass. But they are the low-cost producer of hydroponic greens in,
yeah,
New England. You know, they sell their greens next to in Market Basket.
Yeah.
Compare, you know, right next to other brands from California, and they sell very well there. So, and I think, again, because if you have a choice between something that is the same price as a product that's not local, but equally nutritious and healthy, and it's probably going to be fresher because it's coming
that's
from
right.
here and not coming from, you know, hasn't been spent 5 days in a truck.
That's right. Yeah. And, you know, there are certain sourcing practices from these new efficiencies. For instance, again, I would say maybe go to their website and take a look at who they've invested in, because those are all good companies, mm-hmm, that you could buy things at fair prices, because hydroponics get rid of 80% of persistent pesticide use and glyphosate usage. And it really is a cleaner approach that is cost effective for both the consumer and the producer. So what a chance. I think that it creates, you pick your battles now, you know where to invest in. That's maybe what we'll talk about in a future, mm-hmm, podcast conversation. One thing is for sure, there won't be any food waste with my cranberry can sauce. That's going to be
I do
all
have a
gone.
Fantastic recipe for you.
Is it to pull it out of the can, open
no,
it,
no,
and flip
no,
it upside
no, no.
down?
It's actually making, I grew up eating the same can sauce and I loved it.
Yeah.
I absolutely do. My mother still serves it if I go to her house for Thanksgiving, and I still eat it and love it.
Totally.
There.
Well, thank you for
that. But I can also give you a very good, easy recipe using,
you know, everybody
fresh
has tried. We've got, like, we have chutney recipes coming in. And I think one year we had 6 different things. I think it's known as a problem in our household that I have this addiction. I'm like an addict with it. But hey, Lisa, thank you so much for participating and joining the conversation. And don't forget, sourcing matters.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.